Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 15th day of February, 2020. I'm your host, Mark Call, and I guess the best way to try and start wrapping up a week like this one is with a few representative stories literally dripping with irony. And, of course, that means hypocrisy, too, nowadays. Like the fact that the lying, disgraced, and finally fired former assistant FBI director, acting FBI director, and lying scumbag FBI director, Andrew McCabe, can obviously get away with criminality that non-deep state players would be serving, oh, I don't know, 9 years or more in the federal pen for. The scumbag's attorneys have confirmed that McCabe will not be facing any criminal charges for his crimes. As Zero Hedge writes, Newsmax's John Cardillo summed things up pretty well. "I'm retracting," he said, "my earlier tweets giving benefit of the doubt to Barr and Durham. If anyone should have been made an example of, it was McCabe. He was literally fired for a 1001 criminal violation. It's unacceptable, and it has shaken my faith," he says, "my confidence in both of them." He goes on to explain that McCabe was literally fired for lying to the FBI. And guess what? Roger Stone and General Flynn, among others, have been destroyed for the very same. "Trump needs to pardon them now," he says, "today. Don't wait another second. And if Barr has a problem with that, he ought to resign. At minimum, he's dropped the ball here." And after that, of course, we need to recap the obvious compare and contrast, because some people really are a lot more above the law than others. And yeah, when it comes to proving again that America has descended into a Soviet-style railroad form of justice, this is a pretty darn good example. The lead juror, sick, in the show trial of Roger Stone turns out to be a former Democratic congressional candidate who absolutely despises President Trump and actively posted anti-Trump material on socialist media during the trial, according to a number of sources, including Mike Cernovich and the Daily Caller. First, an overview from Zero Hedge, which says that the disreputable juror Tomika Hart, who actually ended up being the jury foreperson, there's a shocker for you, admitted to being a Stone trial juror in a Facebook post expressing outrage after four prosecutors in the sham trial withdrew from his case and protested the fact that he didn't get as nasty of a sentence as they intended. I guess the death penalty wasn't an option. They wanted up to 9 years for Stone for what amounts to a process crime. Notably, says the piece, James Wolf, former Senate Select Committee on Intelligence staffer, who leaked the top-secret FISA application to his mistress, journalist Ali Watkins, was sentenced to a mere hand slap of 2 months behind bars. Said the faithless juror, quote, "I've kept my silence for months. Initially, it was for my safety." Well, full aside here, folks. I guess fraud, perjury, jury tampering, conspiracy, felonies like that might be considered shutting your mouth for your own safety. Anyway, she continued, "then I decided to remain silent out of fear of politicizing the matter.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
But I can't keep silent any longer. I want to stand up for Aaron Zelinsky, Adam Jed, Michael Mirando, and Jonathan Kravis, the prosecutors on the Roger Stone trial," wrote the scumbag, referring to the prosecutors who allegedly resigned in protest. Zero Hedge points out that it was the Criminally Negligent Network that first reported on Hart's post, but didn't bother to note that she was, in fact, a far-left Democrat. Commercial Appeal, a news outlet affiliated with USA Today, then spoke to Hart and reported details of her, professional background, which match up with the very same person who ran for Congress in 2012. Politico likewise identified her as the former congressional candidate, according to the Daily Caller. Meanwhile, though, Hart, who was in Tennessee running for office in 2012, has a Twitter history littered with anti-Trump propaganda and was actively posting on socialist media during the trial. And this, as attorney and journalist at Technofog points out, raises questions over just how she managed to respond to the juror questionnaire, which asked very specific questions regarding social media, the Mueller investigation, and running for public office. So the question is, did she lie outright, or did the black-robed ringmaster presiding over this railroad job simply choose to, well, not quite overlook them, but maybe pick her especially because of them? Anyway, you slice it, folks, this makes a genuine Soviet-era trial look downright responsible by comparison. Even the Daily Mail piece in the UK pointed out that the level of vicious hatred here raises, quote, questions about fairness that could impact the verdict if it ever gets around to appeal. And they published not only some of her tweets, but things that she had posted, like pictures with former DNC chairwoman, the infamous Donna Brazile. On the day that Stone was railroaded into conviction, the stories note, Tomika Hart posted emojis of hearts and fist pumps. Tweeted President Trump on Thursday, quote, now it looks like the foreperson in the jury in the Roger Stone case had significant bias, he said, kind of understating it. Add that to everything else, and this is not looking good for the, and at least he puts it in quotes, Justice Department. This follows earlier tweets when he said that the witch hunt against Stone for various process crimes was handled in a manner that he called, quote, ridiculous and an insult to our country. And let's not forget, folks, when it comes to railroad jobs, Hart isn't even the first biased anti-Trump juror. Another one is married to a DOJ official who works for the very division that worked in turn to bring down Stone. As the Bradford file puts it, it's worth noting Robert Mueller knew Russia, Russia, Russia collusion was a farce when he went after Roger Stone. His goal was to catch Stone in a process crime to feed the media hysteria of a hoax Mueller knew to be untrue. Roger Stone, the Bradford file writes, was persecuted, and it's Mueller who belongs in prison. And all your host can add to that, folks, is this has exposed what a farce the legal system is, and he would only be the first of a whole lot who deserve to be there. And if anything's getting more obvious by the day, it's that you can count on the only ones being there not being the ones who deserve to be. And from that, we really do have to go here, don't we? President Trump, says a piece from the Gateway Pundit and Christina Layla, has responded to William Barr's rebuke of his DOJ tweets, saying he's not bothered, and that's good, even though it's not good that Barr is still there. And some of us, you may recall, folks, have expressed, to put it mildly, reservations about deep stater William Barr since he was first picked, since he goes all the way back to all kinds of criminal acts and cover-ups of the FBI under previous criminal regimes. I'm thinking of Lon Horiuchi, who is somewhere in witness protection because of the likes of a William Barr, but hey, he was just the first of what turns out to be many. U.S. Attorney General William Barr said in an interview with ABC's Pierre Thomas that President Trump has, quote, never asked me to do anything in a criminal case. But, he added, he should stop tweeting about the DOJ because his tweets, quote, make it impossible for me to do my job, unquote. I have a suspicion, folks, that maybe it's criminal connections that make it impossible for him to really do his job because I don't see any evidence that what he's doing has much to do with justice. Yeah, just us, you bet. I think it's time, he said, to stop the tweeting about the Department of Just Us criminal cases. I have a problem with some of the tweets. As I said at my confirmation hearing, I think the essential role of the Attorney General is to keep law enforcement, the criminal process, sacrosanct.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. My story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, that kind of whopper, no doubt about it, deserves the full chorus on a day like this, because he seems to be saying, yeah, we're going to keep it sacrosanct just like Loretta Lynch mob did. But back to this incredible gut-wrenching, self-serving, and yeah, intelligence-insulting quote from the latest example of a deep state-approved attorney general who wants us to believe he thinks the essential role of the attorney general is to keep law enforcement, the criminal process, sacrosanct, to make sure there's no political interference in it. And I have done that, and I will continue to do that, unquote. And yeah, folks, give me a break. Or yeah, better still, give us a rule of law. Well, to put this in perspective, let's at least review a couple of the presidential tweets that seem to have so upset the deep state attorney general. One of them said, referring to the Soviet-style treatment of Roger Stone, quote, 2 months in jail for a swamp creature, yet 9 years recommended for Roger Stone, who was not even working for the Trump campaign? Gee, that sounds very fair. Rogue prosecutors, maybe? The swamp, unquote. And, hey, what's to argue with in that? Trump also went on to target the Obama creature and so-called Judge Amy Berman Jackson and unleashed on the four prosecutors who abused Roger Stone, saying, quote, is this the judge that put Paul Manafort in solitary confinement, something that not even mobster Al Capone had to endure? How does she treat crooked Hillary Clinton? Just asking. The White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham released a statement Thursday evening saying President Trump is not bothered by the rebuke of the guy who plays Attorney General on TV. Quote, the president wasn't bothered by the comments at all, and he has the right, just like any American citizen, well, we'll come back to that one, folks, to publicly offer his opinions. President Trump, it continued, uses social media very effectively to fight for the American people against injustices in our country, including fake news. The president has full faith and confidence in Attorney General Barr to do his job and uphold the law, unquote, and maybe they should have stopped while they were ahead. I will say this, if the president is looking for a politically opportune time that's now been properly set up to pardon a whole bunch of people, including Roger Stone, and at the same time, arguably, fire a bunch of scumbags, including, obviously, William Barr, but hey, why stop there? The FBI's still headed by a whoremeister, isn't it? I don't think he could ask for a better opportunity. And I promise we'd go here, let's do it now, because some people, of course, have more free speech rights than others. And that seems to include U.S. senators who can read the Constitution. YouTube, says a piece from the Gateway Pundit, and that would be the video arm of Gulag, has taken down video of the Senate floor speech by Senator Rand Paul reading the censored question that he was not allowed to ask during the bogus impeachment trial because he mentioned the name of the man who must not be named. I'll say it again, Eric Sciaramella, 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 the whistleblower who really isn't one at all. Yeah, it says the big tech war on free speech has been taken to a new level with YouTube taking down that video of a United States senator actually engaging in privileged speech, there you go, on the United States Senate floor. Politico reported Thursday that the Chinese propaganda arm in the United States had removed video of Rand Paul reading his impeachment trial question. And by the way, folks, no, I can't prove that Gulag is actually a communist Chinese propaganda arm in the United States. I just have all kinds of pretty much undeniable evidence, so it's my opinion. Anyway, this was after the pitiful excuse for a Chief Justice, John Roberts, refused to pose it to the House managers and allow President Trump's legal team to hear it. Paul then tried for 2 days to get the question asked, but Roberts refused, the first day quietly sending a message to Paul, and the second day verbally refusing the question outright. So on January 30th, Paul left the Senate floor after Roberts' second refusal, and then held an impromptu press conference where he read his question about the origin of the Ukraine impeachment coup plot, and whether two then-National Security Council SIC staffers, Sean Misko and Eric Sciaramella, 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 were involved. And while Paul didn't, in fact, name him as the whistleblower, the mere mention of the name that shall not be named provoked vitriolic criticism of Paul by coup plotters, a.k.a. socialist leftist Democrats, and the filing of a Senate ethics complaint against him. And now YouTube has removed videos of the Senator Paul press conference. The reporter, Kristen Taylor, says two of them, in fact, linked by her, were taken down by YouTube as well. Politico Playbook reported that Senator Paul told them, quote, it's a chilling and disturbing day in America when giant web companies such as YouTube decide to censure speech. Now, he said, even protected speech, such as that of a senator on the Senate floor, can be blocked from getting to the American people. This is dangerous and politically biased. And he added, nowhere in my speech did I accuse anyone of being a whistleblower, nor do I know the whistleblower's identity, unquote. But to their credit, at least, C-SPAN and Twitter have not, yet anyway, censored the video of Paul's speech on the floor. Item. CNN reported this week that the Air Force has updated its dress code policy to include turbans, beards, and hijabs, a clear approval process for Sikhs and Muslims, it says, who want to serve while wearing their articles of faith. How nice for Big Brother-approved religions. But, of course, just don't even think about having a Bible on your desk there. What all that leads me to is a two-part examination of one aspect of the extremism that's taken over the far left of late. Let's start with a piece from Paul Joseph Watson. He's penned a couple of these over the last few days about what's called hashtag trad wives. In other words, traditional women who actually want to be wives, mothers, housemakers, and not politically correct, perhaps because they can even read scripture. But Achtung, don't they dare talk about it online. The BBC may have kicked it off when they said they'd introduce us to hashtag trad wife, a young woman who's chosen to be a traditional wife, staying at home to take care of the household chores while her husband works, and she's fine with submitting to her husband as he makes the key decisions in their lives, prompting the New York Times op-ed to say, running alongside what could be mistaken for a peculiar style of mommy blogging is a virulent strain of white nationalism. Who are these women? They screeched. They call themselves trad wives. And Becca Lewis went on to say, who needs YouTube rabbit holes when you have the BBC broadcasting literal white supremacist propaganda? But the London Stand socialists weren't done yet. As Watson noted, the London Times then became the latest media outlet to suggest that embracing traditional gender roles is a form of extremism in an article that claims so-called trad wives are literally on a par with ISIS brides. And their headline puts it this way, trad wives meet the women radicalized into complete subservience to men. Yes, reports Julie Ebner, who, in case you're curious, works for the so-called Institute for Strategic Dialogue, a think tank that partners with national governments, Gulag, and many others to, quote, counter hate and extremism in the UK. While what they're really up to, of course, is the exact opposite. A growing online community of women are rejecting feminism in favor of submission to men. In other words, reading the Bible, folks, is something that is absolutely verboten so far as they're concerned. The techniques, they say, used to radicalize them are similar to those used to groom ISIS brides. All right, well, enough of that for now, but it does set the stage for this other interesting piece written by Julian Vigo at counterpunch.org. entitled, How Privilege and Woke Politics Are Destroying the Left. And this is actually a lament from somebody that's been on the inside and seems to be recognizing just how they're self-destructing. Says the author, I was in a Slack group for gender-critical academics in the UK, started by a UK feminist who's become known over the past 18 months for her critique of gender identity. The inception of this group seemed promising. Or rather, it was, until this individual and several others within it took it upon themselves to malign women who were doing political activism in the U.S. Whereafter, I wrote an article about the toxicity and elitist politics taking place in the heart of feminist circles. And he goes on to say the defamation was astonishing to witness, as it put into the crosshairs feminists who were not operating from the safety of academic tenure, and it enacted gross misrepresentations of these women who felt the fallout of the attacks for months. And since the attack took place largely on Twitter, the pile-on effect was pronounced as the shit was stirred for weeks, even if the posh feminists quickly pretended they'd had nothing to do with the ensuing political goulash they alone had concocted. And in response to having written the article, I was kicked out of the group, as I was informed via email. So much, he writes, for academic discussions that allow for diverse, even non-woke positions. And all your host can add here is, surprise, surprise, surprise! Over the past year, the author continues, I've seen this kind of dynamic repeated hundreds of times and spiral out of control within two Facebook groups and Twitter. Indeed, it seems in 2020 that it's far better to bring the discussions a witty one-liner, rather than take your interlocutor seriously and engage in calm and respectful debate. And here's the current situation, folks. Instead of listening and agreeing disagreeably, as the old saying goes, socialist media, I put that part in there, is awash in individuals attempting to one-up the next person through either engaging in woke or privilege politics. And while those two are interrelated, they do function independently as well. He goes on to describe them, saying, privilege politics work like this. You act in bad faith with your opponent, claiming that the fact that this person is male, white, married, or heterosexual, for instance, he cannot possibly be anything other than some caricature you alone have created. Are males really incapable of grasping sexism because they're inherently engineered to grope women? Are light-skinned people really unable to understand the experiences of immigration, and they're always and forever racist? And are even feminists who do not kowtow to another form of gender wokeism necessarily part of the far right, and thus equally deserving of maligning? Such tactics, he laments, have become a thing of the left in recent years. It's almost as if, and listen to this, folks, and ponder the irony, the wokerati are a new brand of right-wing intolerance, recycled from the era of the moral majority. And I won't bore you with the disgusting examples that he trots out, but it does demonstrate the bias anyway. which makes the rest all the more interesting. Between the maligning of the other based on mischaracterization or their perceived privilege and the simultaneous slewing of woke narrative of what's wrong or right while maintaining that no other positions are even worthy of being heard lest we redeem Nazism, we are living in an era of neo-Puritanism. Give me a break. Even a tiny pushback against rampant Satanism seems to trigger these people. But it is really educational to see the leftist perspective once they start to realize just how far gone they really are. Privilege politics, writes Vigo, operates through the constant attempt to undermine any kind of meaningful political dialogue through delegitimizing the other because of their sex, skin color, class, facility with PC gender pronouns. I put that in there. And they left out the litany of other politically correct adjectives, rendering their person as part of the problem. Enter wokeness, stage left, where privilege posturing segues into the narrative of the moral observer. And ponder the irony in that, folks. Who's the mostest wokest? Now continues this leftist, I have to confess, I've been without a solid source of internet for months, and as a result, I've spent far less time on socialist media, which has lent me some healthy perspective on how socialist media functions to feed the ego, while sanitizing the terrain of those who object with our ideas. He notes that block and mute are the BFFs of most of these folks, and it's a great micro-world where we allow ourselves to obsess over our every political ideal while we bask in the likes and mute anyone who disagrees with us. Because, yes, he continues, virtuality is a fake space where we can superficially turn off all white noise, pun intended, and label this superficial calm as consensus. And come to think of it, didn't he just describe what now passes for climate science? He quotes one political commentator who says, Twitter is where the people who care the most spend their time and where cultural kingmakers congregate. All through the microbursts of public commentary, which is overwhelmingly instantaneous and, yep, even misinformed. And the irony in the rest of the piece is that he quotes a whole bunch of leftists who seem to disagree among themselves, and then says this, we'll get nowhere by pretending that everyone who disagrees with us is, quote, cozying up to the conservative right. Do you see the blind spot here that's about a light year across? We need to change our tactics, concludes the author, and how we interact in the world politically. And this change must begin with having good faith discussions that are not steeped in wokeism or privilege games. Well, I guess as long as we stay with those who are comfortably far enough left, that's okay. But for the real conclusion, I return to Paul Joseph Watson and his piece about hashtag tradwives, which he notes is largely just a meme on Twitter. But it's definitely a microcosm of the bigger issue. There exists, says Watson, a tiny minority of people in the West who want to embrace more traditional, or, as your host would put it, biblical-based gender roles in order to escape the degenerate hellscape, his terminology, of modernity that has contributed to record-high depression and suicide rates amongst young people. And for that, he says correctly, these people are being demonized on a par with actual terrorists. Bottom line, and understand this, the media hates you. They hate everything you stand for, they hate your Bible, and arguably, most importantly of all, they hate your God. Which gives me just enough time to recap one more brief, not important event from this week, but it continues that theme, celebrating the self-obsessed, super-spoiled, rich kids of Hollywood as they pat themselves on their own oh-so-woke backs. To my surprise, though, the best summary of the story came from the UK's Daily Mail. And in spite of the legion of stories peddling the usual pap, who's best dressed, worst dressed, who's partying with who, and so forth, predictably, most of the stories focused on pictures and stories about the glitterati, and yet, they did manage to at least get this part correct. Joaquin Phoenix and Brad Pitt, wrote the Daily Mail, led a chorus of complaining celebrities at Sunday night's Oscars where stars gave sermons on human rights, animal rights, and, of course, politics. And while the well-heeled crowd of the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles applauded their speeches, their lectures literally nauseated the audience at home. And many, they wrote, of the viewers took to Twitter to slam the stars as hypocrites and called the event the wokest Oscars ever. This is kind of a cute way to summarize the piece. One disgusted Twitter user wrote, ah, the Oscars, a time for overpaid entertainers to lecture me about income inequality. And we'll be right back. Well, Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm still your host, Mark Call, and we haven't talked yet about the coronavirus update for the week. The word perfect storm has been used again on several fronts, not only epidemiological, but economic. So let's get rolling, and I'll start here with a story that bridges the gap between fall of the money and fall of the virus. China, says a financial piece for Bloomberg, has given out the first of its force majeure certificates to companies hit by the coronavirus. In this case, a car parts supplier is one of the first known. It actually happened on February 2nd, and it took a while to percolate out, from an organization called the China Council for the Promotion of International Trade, which is supposedly recognized by enterprises, governments, trade associations, and customs officials in more than 200 places around the world, said C.C. Pitt. And the idea is that it's kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card for companies that can't perform on contracts. The certificate, says the piece, can excuse those companies from either not performing or partially performing contractual duties because of extraordinary circumstances beyond their control. And the coronavirus contagion, as you're probably aware, has shuttered plants all across China, a disruption that they say could get much worse if rolling quarantines and suspended rail and air links prevent the return of millions of blue-collar laborers to their workstations. In this case, the first company is one that produces components for engines, as well as transmissions and automobile steering systems, according to their website. And it's car manufacturer Peugeot that'll take the first blow. But the important thing to note here is another domino has fallen. But it's not the only one. Copper buyers and the world's largest buyer of LNG, or liquefied natural gas, China National Offshore Oil Corporation, have also declared force majeure and walked away from purchase contracts. And there was a really big stink earlier in the week out of China about test kits, too, which seemed to show a huge number of false negatives. In other words, hey, nothing to see here. These people really aren't sick. Move along, move along. From there, back we go to markets and the issue of, eventually, the truth might come out. And as the summary headline from Zero Hedge says, markets were hit on Thursday by the perfect storm as stocks slid on a surge in new coronavirus cases and admitted deaths. For weeks, they begin, we've been warning that China was misrepresenting, obfuscating, and otherwise lying, either directly or simply by changing the definition of what an infected case or even death was anymore, about the true extent of the corona pandemic, a conclusion that was obvious, and they cite a number of references, when you look at the underlying official data. But on Thursday morning, the quants and algos got a huge shock when China was finally overwhelmed with the level of lies and cremated bodies, it would seem, since the breakout of the COVID pandemic, and was finally forced to adjust the number of new cases higher by a whopping 15,000. It's a bit like what happens when the Bureau of Lying Statistics, folks, has to come out and say, oops, the real numbers are getting too far out of line with what we've been claiming. We'd better adjust last month's data. The result, it says, has been a sharp drop in U.S. equity futures and global stock prices as it raised fresh questions about the scale of the crisis. Gee, do you think? And more importantly, how long will it take China to truly contain the pandemic, even as markets had taken comfort from the WHO's emergency program head describing the apparent slowdown in the spread of the epidemic as very reassuring. Well, they've been caught lying a lot, too. As a reminder, it says, with consensus expectations that China would eventually regain control over perhaps the next few weeks, any delay puts the V-shaped second quarter China, and in fact global GDP recovery, in peril. And as such, the longer China pushes back on this critical D-Day, the harder it's going to be for traders to pretend the pandemic isn't happening. And so the sharp rise in the headline number of official deaths and infections unnerved world markets as traders halted a recent rally in stocks and retreated back to the safety of government bonds and, of course, real stuff like gold and silver. Paper versions of which, at least, are both up between 0.5% and 1% after being capped of late. And when it comes to lies being revealed, and maybe even corrected, it wasn't just the surge in new cases, says Zero Hedge. Health officials in China's central province of Hubei, at least those who weren't summarily fired over the last couple of days, said 242 people had died officially from the flu-like virus on Wednesday. That's the fastest rise in the daily count since the pathogen was allegedly identified, well, you know, at least outside the lab, in December. Apparently, this too was due to a change in definition, as until now, China was presenting coronavirus deaths as a result of something far more innocent, like pneumonia. Well, no more. So the new deaths took the total to 1,369, versus 6,017 that they claim have recovered, which amounts to an 18.5% fatality rate if one looks at that ratio, and a Spanish flu 2.2% if one looks at total cases, if they're now accurate, says Rabobank. And ironically, the surge in numbers came just a day or so after markets cheered when China reported its lowest number of new cases in 2 weeks. Remember, folks, this was right after the weekend D-Day passed, so we kind of expected it, didn't we? Bolstering the forecast by the country's senior medical advisor that the epidemic would probably end by April. Well, no more. And to make all of these points, Zero Hedge shows a couple of charts of both new deaths and new cases officially in China, and there's a huge spike as of yesterday. And all of this, they say, is explained because the new methodology lowers the bar for classifying new infections, which contributed to the spike. And Chinese officials claim, so far at least, the method is only being used in Hubei. We can't have all of the real cases being reported immediately now, can we? That spike would have looked more like a moonshot, although it was expected to be gradually extended to other regions. When it's all said and done, says Zero Hedge, as well as a number of analysts that they're quoting, given the economic impacts and other negative data coming out, the impact of the virus could be the perfect storm, or at least the perfect excuse for what's coming anyway. While we're on the subject this evening, though, there is one more harbinger of concern we ought to talk about. From Michael Snyder at the end of the American Dream blog, the U.S. military has initiated what they call their global campaign plan for a pandemic. In other words, it looks like they're taking the coronavirus outbreak extremely seriously. Now here, folks, your host has to add, that would be true of a beta test too now, wouldn't it? And an executive order has been issued, which initiated the implementation of, quote, the Department of Defense Global Campaign Plan for Pandemic Influenza and Infectious Diseases 3551-13. Well, he writes, we don't know all of the details of the plan, and of course you're not intended to, but we do know that it instructs U.S. military officials to, quote, prepare for widespread outbreaks. While many in the mainstream media try to convince us that the virus is not much more dangerous than the common flu, hey, so get your vaccinations today and you can try it yourself. But if that's true, he asks, then why is our military taking such a dramatic step? Whereupon he quotes from a Military Times article that says the EO issued by the Joint Staff and approved by Defense Secretary Mark Esper this month directs NORTHCOM and geographic combatant commanders to initiate pandemic plans, which include ordering commanders to prepare for widespread outbreaks and confining service members with a history of travel to China. The Navy and Marine Corps messages issued Tuesday and Wednesday, respectively, referenced the EO directing NORTHCOM, or U.S. Northern Command, to implement that DOD plan with the very long name. For now, says Snyder, we're not being told the specific details. And when NORTHCOM was asked about it, they responded with the typical vague pablum about how their goal is to ensure the U.S. military is poised to respond as required, and that they have a culture of planning and blah-de-blah-de-blah. So yeah, folks, preparation is fine, and hey, wouldn't it be neat if we did that at the southern border, where the real invasion and real threat is almost certainly escalating as we speak. But it's also true, of course, and shouldn't be overlooked, that there's nothing like a national emergency to expand Big Brother's governmental powers big time. And while hopefully the United States won't end up responding like Communist China, where, for example, a Daily Mail headline about how China's rounding up coronavirus suspects showed a video of the, quote, shocking moment one woman desperately screams while she was being put in a metal box as she and others were dragged away from their home by officers in hazmat suits. We do have some notable cautionary notes, because no doubt about it, we've got far too many Eric Swalwells who've already threatened doing worse, and we've already seen video of a plethora of Bolshevik Bernie's campaign leaders who literally want to put deplorables in gulags, and yeah, they're more than willing to rig the court system too, or overturn elections. So the bottom line here is easy. When it comes to tyranny on the march, don't let your guard down. Which somehow, coincidentally, reminds me, we shouldn't forget the New Hampshire primary this week. Who'd be the worst possible candidate that the socialists could nominate to be next dictator for the United States? Well, it's a tough call. But certainly New Hampshire gives us a clue. Yeah, they're all anti-constitutional, anti-life, anti-freedom, and certainly gun banners. Bolshevik Bernie the other day, for example, said it's virtually impossible to be a real Democrat and not be pro-abortion. He didn't even have to make the even more obvious comment when it came to being pro-stealing people's guns and absolutely anti-Second Amendment. So yeah, he clearly won New Hampshire, and the best the deep state could do with their candidate, whether they rigged this one or not, like Iowa, was second place. In the latest update I saw before beginning this recording, with 85% of New Hampshire precincts reporting, Bolshevik Bernie's lead over Mayor Buttigieg is narrowed, with the communist candidate coming in with almost 26% of the far-left New Hampshire vote, while the deep state anti-Bible candidate is in second place, just short of 25%. While the DNC pick, Amy Klobuchar, who is in third place with 20%, meaning that the early favorites for the far left, Elizabeth Warren, a.k.a. Pocahontas, and creepy quid pro Joe, I did not have nepotism with that Burisma Ukrainian, Biden, you deplorable, lying, dog-faced pony soldier, you, is in a dismal fifth place. And it seems neither Creepy Joe nor Pocahontas are going to get any New Hampshire delegates. Says most of the analysis, Sanders, who soundly defeated Hitler here in 2016 and is, of course, from neighboring Vermont, was expected to perform well here. While Pocahontas, like Sanders, a senator from a neighboring state, was also hoping to finish near the top. So this may be her swan song. And of course, good riddance is a good two-word summary of your host reaction to her hopeful political extinction. Creepy Joe is already in South Carolina, where he's already live-streamed that, quote, we're in a battle for the soul of the nation, unquote, and doesn't that describe the adversary from times immemorial, while the criminally negligent network's John King proclaimed that it was a very bad night for Pocahontas and Creepy Joe, saying, quote, you're not first, you're not second, you're not third anywhere on the map. That's the definition of a very bad night. It was a bad night, too, for Colorado do-nothing Senator Michael Bennett, disgraced to the state. He suspended his campaign and basically nobody noticed, along with Andrew Yang, who said he looked at the math, and gee, it's about time, and said he couldn't see a path to victory. Of course, he's never been able to see the Constitution or understand economics, so why are we not surprised? Pocahontas, trying to put the best possible spin on her devastating loss, said, we cannot afford to fall into factions, and called for unity, which prompted the president to pile on and tweet the following. Elizabeth Warren, sometimes referred to as Pocahontas, is having a really bad night. I think she's sending signals that she wants out. Calling for unity is her way of getting there, going home and having a nice cold beer with her husband. Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden, in their summary, reminded us that in modern history, no candidate who's placed worse than second in New Hampshire has still gone on and managed to become their party's nominee. And as expected, President Trump not only overwhelmingly won New Hampshire's GOP primary, but took over 86% of the vote, eclipsing the record set by Ronald Reagan in 1984 and amassing more votes in the primary than any other incumbent president in history. And he seemed disappointed, but I don't think he was really surprised, that nobody was paying any attention to it in what he called the fake news media. He said, it's looking hard for a big Democrat story, but nothing fabulous. Wouldn't the big story be that I got more New Hampshire primary votes than any other incumbent president in either party in the history of that great state? Not an insignificant fact, unquote, but certainly one that they'd just as soon ignore. And by the way, the current president got more than twice as many New Hampshire votes as incumbent Obama did at the end of his first term in 2012. Over 120,000 as opposed to not even 50,000. And as for the other takeaway for the socialist left, as Zero Hedge's Tyler Durden put it, moderate Democrats, are there any left, have some tough choices because over 50% of New Hampshire voters went for either Buttigieg, Klobuchar, or Creepy Joe last night, while the far-left candidates Sanders and Warren captured about a third of the vote, 36% to be precise, and while the deep state Buttigieg may be the moderate winner, sick, over the last two contests, they note that former New York City mayor, billionaire, and gun banner extraordinaire Michael Bloomberg has been making strides, according to national polls that are pretty easily bought and paid for, I guess. So until Biden and Klobuchar drop out, they say, moderate Democrats, sick, won't be able to elevate a centrist to try to beat Sanders for the nomination, and despite his broad support over the past 2 weeks, the gay deep state guy is miles away from Sanders in national polls. Oh, and one more thing to consider, they note, will Southern Bible Belt Democrats actually vote for a gay president who has admittedly a pretty poor reputation within the black community? Or, as The Hill asks, will Democrats end up in a contested convention in which no one arrives in Milwaukee with the required 1,990 delegates to secure the nomination? And yeah, folks, I'm sure you can all imagine the horror stories that that might lead to. especially since, by the time the week was wrapped up, it looks like, at least almost, so is Creepy Joe Biden's campaign. And since, just maybe, hopefully, we won't have Creepy Joe to kick around too much longer, I need to recap this one while there's still time. Creepy quid pro Joe Biden was on Where Else? The MSNBC, mostly socialist that never believed the Constitution, joining his comrade, Morning Joe. And as Zero Hedge notes, he seems to have backed off from his position that because Bolshevik Bernie actually comes out and admits he's a dyed-in-the-wool socialist, at least, he might actually lose to President Trump. Now, though, the aging Alzheimer's-oriented mob boss is saying this, quote, I refuse to suggest any Democrat can lose. I think we could run Mickey Mouse against this president and have a shot, unquote. And hey, folks, that seems to be a better campaign slogan than what he's got, because that's exactly what he's hoping the idiots on the socialist far left will end up doing. And given their candidate choices, it looks like that's precisely what they intend to do. And lest we have any doubts on that score, I'll go to one of my favorites when it comes to the bottom of the trash pile anyway. Gun-banning anti-constitutionalist billionaire extraordinaire Michael Bloomberg, who's had some controversy erupt, it would seem, because of what he actually says. A viral clip unearthed from 2015 featuring the man who would be king defending stop and frisk in totalitarian New York City has gone viral after a podcaster named Benjamin Dixon unearthed audio of the former three-term NYC mayor telling the Aspen Institute that the program targeted minority kids who must be, quote, thrown up against the wall in order to disarm them. Now listen to this, folks, and ponder the Freudian slip here. You've got to get the guns out of the hands of people that are getting killed, he said during his tirade, and that seems to be exactly what he intends to do with all of America. And he's obviously willing to throw all the rest of us up against the wall and shoot us if necessary in order to complete his disarmament of a formerly free people. And maybe it'll help that the president has weighed in too, saying, quote, wow, Bloomberg is a total racist, unquote. But given the far left field we're talking about here, that's hardly disqualifying, even if it's obvious Mickey Mouse would indeed make a far better president than this scumbag. From there, we turn next to one of your host's longtime favorite investigative journalists and authors, James Bovard, who's weighed in again on the gun seizures that seem inevitable in formerly free America. They could lead to war, he says, for the Future of Freedom Foundation, and reprinted a number of places from Zero Hedge to LouRockwell.com. He begins by quoting the evil Irishman who ran for president masquerading as Hispanic, Robert Francis, a.k.a. Beto O'Rourke, who said, hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15 at a Democrat presidential candidate debate back in September. Says Bovard, compelling Americans to surrender their so-called assault weapons is the newest purity test for far-left socialist wannabe, a.k.a. Democrat presidential candidates, according to none other than the WAPO. And he lists a whole bunch of the cretins who've already endorsed mandatory so-called buybacks, yeah, buy 'em back at gunpoint or else, of what they define as assault weapons. And all of this, he said, while at least apparently politically profitable for the far left, could start a cascade of public policy dominoes ending in civil war. When Australia and New Zealand, which don't have nearly the history of freedom and firearms ownership that America has, mandated buybacks of assault weapons, most gun owners ignored the decrees, despite politicians repeatedly ratcheting up their threats. And similar noncompliance to color of law, mandating surrender or registration of assault weapons, in socialist enclaves like California, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and elsewhere, have been similarly and rightfully ignored. And even after the Clinton-era assault weapons ban that lasted for a decade was finally reversed, a WAPO editorial admitted, quote, assault weapons play a part in only a small percentage of crime. The provision is mainly symbolic. Its virtue, they believed, will be if it turns out to be, as hoped, a stepping stone to broader gun control, unquote, and of course, ultimately, confiscation. One of their leftist heroes, Charles Krauthammer, in an article headlined, Disarm the Citizenry, but not yet, explained the real logic of the ban. Its only justification, he said, is not to reduce crime, but to desensitize the public to the regulation of weapons in preparation for their ultimate confiscation. How's that for honest journalism, folks? This from the guy who's trumpeted real steps on gun control, including the banning of handguns. Bovard goes on to quote the likes of the evil Eric Swalwell of California, who famously wanted a mandatory national ban of anything he declared to be an assault weapon, saying that his proposal is bold. It rightly treats gun violence as a life or death matter, while seeking, of course, to create more of it than ever and end a whole bunch of people's lives in the process. A Twitter critic summarized Swalwell's pitch this way: "We're not taking anyone's legal guns. We're just changing the law so guns are illegal, and then we'll take them." And, of course, when a conservative activist pointed out that what Swalwell really wanted was a war, he replied, quote, "It would be a short war, my friend. The government has nukes." And notes Bovard, echoing that same totalitarian line, quid pro Joe, former Vice President Biden, scoffed back in September that, quote, "If you want to protect yourself against the federal government, you're going to need at least an F-15, unquote. Well, that might have helped a few people at Ruby Ridge, Waco, and other places where the FBI has stepped in to help. But notes Bovard, in clashes between government agents and citizenry, weaponry is not destiny. He pointed out that in August 1992, in that initial firefight at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, a camouflage team of U.S. Marshals with submachine guns was routed by a 14-year-old boy with a Ruger Mini-14, and then his 25-year-old father with a .30-06. That, of course, didn't stop the FBI from bringing in more firepower and later killing Vicki Weaver while she stood holding her baby. But it does make his point. After each of the initial debacles, both at Ruby Ridge and then, of course, more famously, Waco, the FBI came in and made the situation far worse, and in the latter case, killed a whole bunch more people, demonstrating, as Bovard puts it, that those who portray practically every privately owned firearm as a school massacre waiting to happen will scorn the rights of the masses of government victims. But here's the key, folks, and it's also the threat that your host has been talking about for quite a while. Many rural gun owners, says James Bovard, are as unlikely to surrender their guns as they are to give up their Bibles. Escalating government force will create martyrs that multiply resistance. We've seen it before, the aforementioned incidents, and going all the way back to the British government's heavy-handed repression of the Bostonians at that Tea Party, which turned a smattering of activists into 13 colonies against King George. Meaning that any vigorous attempt to forcibly commandeer millions of weapons will result in clashes that the government will sometimes lose, especially given the record of police who either freeze up or cower in crisis situations, including the Parkland shooting, the Las Vegas Mandalay Hotel carnage, and the Orlando Pulse nightclub massacre. Any attempt, writes Bovard, to enforce widespread gun confiscation will require suspending, that's his word, I'd say putting a final stake, in Americans' constitutionally, at least once upon a time, protected right to trial by jury. But that's not all. The First Amendment would be another gun-grab casualty. During the final day at Waco, the FBI continually broadcast the lie, "This is not an assault," as its tanks collapsed about 20% of the Davidian's home and prepared it for the upcoming inferno. The videos, he said, of the FBI tank assault swayed far more Americans to completely reject not just the federal claims about Waco, but to question whether the entire government had far too much power for the safety of American citizens. Almost everybody with a cell phone nowadays, though, has a video camera within reach, and film clips of federal agents smashing into homes and assailing defiant citizens would be more incendiary than any presidential tweet. Such optics, he writes, would prove disastrous unless the government can prevent uploading any such videos to the Internet. Oh, and isn't this interesting, folks? Exactly what Big Brother Beijing seems to be practicing for now. And he notes that there are plenty of sheriffs, too, that have read their oath of office. And in places like New York State, New Mexico, Colorado, and, of course, Virginia, they've already publicly refused to enforce what they know to be unjust gun laws that violate the supreme law of the land. So as a result, the only way to carry out such mass seizures in many parts of the nation would be by declaring martial law. And, oh, I can't help but think, again, doesn't that make a coronavirus-like scenario just so convenient? Concludes Bovard, citizens ought to also remember that the government that claims a right to seize their firearms also denies they have any legal obligation to protect them from violent criminals. You mean like the ones they're fixing to send? It's all about trust, and the more we study to show ourselves approved, the more we'll know who deserves it and who doesn't.